Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org, on the WDIY app, and many streaming services. Today is October 29th, 2025. The markets were mixed today, with the Dow closing down at 47,632, the NASDAQ up at 23,958, and the S&P down at 6,890. Our topic tonight is further considerations in estate planning. We are live tonight. We'll take your questions. Bob and Cindy are in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I'll do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. You can speak live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable speaking on air, you can give your question to Cindy and they'll bring it into the studio. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. I welcome a guest this evening, attorney Eric Strauss of Gross McGinley Attorneys at Law. Eric focuses his practice on estate planning, probate and estate administration, revocable and irrevocable trust planning and administration, Pennsylvania inheritance tax, federal estate and gift tax, fiduciary income tax for trust and estates, and orphans court litigation. He also handles related real estate and small business succession. He's authored numerous articles and is a critically acclaimed speaker for community and professional groups. That's how I met him, including the National Business Institute, Pennsylvania Bar Institute, and National Business Institute. Oops, I said that twice. A recognized leader in his field, Eric is a member of the American College of Trust and Estate Council. To qualify for membership, a lawyer must have no less than 10 years' experience in the active practice of probate and trust law or estate planning. Lawyers and law professors are elected to be fellows based on their outstanding reputation, exceptional skill, and substantial contributions to the field by lecturing, writing, teaching, and participating in bar activities. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Great to be here, Lori. It's been a while.
Yes, it has been a while, but it's great to have you, and you're always top of mind. And I know that you've had some recent changes, so do you want to kind of bring the audience up to speed? So I mentioned that you're at Gross McGinley, and the last time you were on, you were at Worth McGee and Fisher.
Yeah, I was with a small firm, Worth McGee and Fisher, for better part of 35 years. Last summer, one of my partners retired, another decided to make a career shift. So my remaining partner and I picked up our stakes and closed down the old firm and landed at Gross McGinley, and I'm very happy there. Great mm-hmm. group of people.
Mm-hmm. And we've had other attorneys from Gross McGinley on as well. And so there is a number of practice areas that they have there as well. So that kind of opens up the door for more collaboration, I would say.
It does. It gives me a lot of bandwidth. Mm-hmm. You know, there are things that in the past I really couldn't handle in-house. I would always have to refer to other lawyers, but now I can say, you know, if your child's going through a divorce or if you're contemplating a divorce, I can introduce you to someone down the hall.
Yeah, that works out nicely. So congratulations on the move. I'm excited to hear how it's going and all of that. But tonight we are sitting together to talk about our favorite subject, estate planning. And as I mentioned, I did meet Eric many years ago at a continuing education seminar put on by the National Bar Institute, I believe, Eric, and I think it was on Pennsylvania State Administration. And I was so impressed with Eric then, And he's accomplished so much more since then. So it's nice to bring him on to share his expertise. So tonight's topic, we called it Further Considerations in Estate Planning. So Eric, I thought it might be kind of fun to take maybe one little area and then dig a little deeper on it. So for example, I talked about if you're working with an attorney for your estate planning, that's great. We want you to work with an attorney for your estate planning. But let's take it a step further. What if something happens to that attorney? And the reason I thought of this is I thought, well, you made a move. So I think people say, hey, you know, I tried to reach my attorney. He's not there anymore. What happens? So can you kind of talk for a minute about those situations where you may have had an attorney? The attorney may have moved. The attorney may have retired. The attorney may have died. Can you kind of give us some parameters around what a client or someone who's experienced this would need to do or think about?
I know that when I switched firms, we sent out about 2,000 letters to my existing clients, active clients, which is a duty imposed upon you. The Pennsylvania Bar Association has rules of professional responsibility that govern attorney conduct. And communication with a client is a very important concept. Notifying a client of moves like that. In my case, you know, my prior firm was a small firm, so I had a plan in place that if something happened to me, what would happen to my client files? It's something we take very seriously. The problem is not all lawyers do. Or not all lawyers ever develop their plan and something tragic happens. They're killed in a car accident, something like that. And in those cases, clients can be left sort of adrift. One of the big issues is different firms have different policies on retaining original documents. So when I do wills or powers of attorney or trusts for clients, some of them want me to keep the originals. Not all lawyers accept that responsibility. I do. And if I do that, I have extra obligations imposed upon me. So when we moved firms, I brought, I'm not going to even tell you how many wills with me, but I can tell you it filled 100 banker's boxes. And every client has to be notified so they know where it is, and they have to be given the opportunity. If the client said, well, I liked you when you were at your old firm, I don't like this new firm, that's the client's choice. I don't own the file. But it ties into a whole other issue with, you know, what you do with original documents. If you're the client, you want to keep them. But it is nice. I mean, one of the nice things about being in a larger firm is there's an automatic succession plan. You know, in the old firm, if something happened to me, there was a plan in place, but it would have been harder to implement. Now I'm at a large firm that's not going anywhere anytime soon.
You have a deeper bench of attorneys to take on that work.
Correct, which is nice. And it gives me, so it does give my clients a lot of security to know that.
Because how long were you at Worth McGee?
Better part of 35 years.
Okay, part of 35 years. That's a lot of clients.
Yeah.
And those clients, you know, hopefully would like to retain those relationships so they can follow you, as you said, and if you have the original documents, they now know where they are. Clients sometimes do keep the original documents as well, but they get the same letter and notification that you've moved,
Correct.
So they can still contact you and et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully under the Bar Association's rules of conduct for attorneys, they have in play plans for whether it's retiring, passing away, or leaving for another firm. So that's really good to know.
That's correct. And technology makes it easy, a lot easier to do that now. Anyone who sends anything to my old email address, it's automatically forwarded to my new email address. Same with our phone number. So it you know, that's to the client's benefit. And I routinely, I mean, I've been in the new firm since January. I routinely have people who send email to my old email address.
Well, because that's what pops up when you go to type.
That's right.
Folks, we're at our first break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. I have in the studio with me this evening attorney Eric Strauss of Gross McGinley, and we're talking about further considerations in estate planning. We were just talking about if an attorney, you know, retires, passes away, leaves. But Eric, it made me think. Sometimes people want the attorney to keep the documents, maybe because they're afraid someone else is going to get into their records, look at it, snoop around. Whether
tear it
it's,
up.
Yeah, tear it up. That's another one. Yeah. So if someone passes away and the attorney has the original documents, how is there ever a problem with someone finding the document? So, for example, let's pretend my mom passes away and I go to the house and I can't find a will anywhere. And how am I going to know that it's at the attorney's office if there's not a trail? Do we have to figure out a trail?
It's your mom's job to tell you that my original will is in this location.
Okay.
Because in some states there are repositories where a will can be filed with the court before someone dies. In Pennsylvania, there is no way to do that. Anyone whose documents I do, there would be a cover letter that presumably the family would find with the copies that says, I have your original will in our vault, or you have chosen to keep your original will. If I have a client who says, I want to keep my original will, I ask them, where are you going to keep it? Is it going to be in the freezer? Which you'd be surprised over the years how many estates I've probated where the will was in the freezer, which is fine until it gets thrown away with the old roast. But it's a very important ingredient of this because, and there's an interesting presumption in Pennsylvania. If a will is known to be in the possession of the person who signed it, what we call the testator, and you can't find an original, there's a very strong presumption that it was destroyed. Mm-hmm. Whereas if the will is in the lawyer or the scrivener, if it's in my possession and my office blows up and no one can find the original, it's a lot easier to probate a copy of a will. Mm-hmm. But if the will, again, if it's in the testator's possession, it can't be located, there's a very strong presumption it was destroyed, and it can be very difficult to probate a copy.
A copy. So I had heard that... I had not realized that, if someone thought they lost the original. But I think I had heard, if there was a known fire or something like that, it would be more likely that
Correct.
The court might
Correct.
Accept
In
it.
In that context, if there's evidence and testimony that, yes, I know my dad, I know his will was in this cabinet, which was destroyed in the kitchen fire, that would be credible evidence that, there was a will that was destroyed. But the safer course is to, if I tell people who want to keep their own will, it really should be in a safe deposit box in a bank outside your home. Mm. A lot of people say, well, I have a safe. Mm-hmm. Your safe isn't fireproof. It's fire rated, either for a temperature or for a certain number, a period of time. And when you have a fully involved house fire, a lot of times things in those safes just turn to ash.
Interesting. And you hope that you didn't turn to ash with it.
Correct.
Because then you could just do a new will.
Correct. But,
okay, very good. Now, so we did talk about those situations where an attorney may change, keeping copies. So, yeah, the expected documents. We can't have a show on estate planning without talking about the expected documents, the will, the power of attorney, living will, health care, maybe a trust. You mentioned and this I kind of forgot about, even though you would have the original, you are giving copies to the client.
Sure.
So you expect that that would be in the home somewhere. You're giving a cover letter indicating to your clients they really need to tell the executor or personal representative where that is. So that's really good advice. And people may not, you know, people like to be so private that they forget that there is a secondary responsibility in that. So how often should those documents be reviewed? And you're welcome to, you know, add your stamp of approval on getting documents as well.
Lawyers, you know, estate planning lawyers, it's not like the dentist. People don't usually see me every year. Certainly any major life event, a death in the family, change in circumstances of any of your heirs or any of the fiduciaries. When I say fiduciary, that would be the person who's acting as your agent under a healthcare power of attorney or a financial power of attorney or a trustee or an executor. If those people's circumstances change, that would, you know, prompt you to change your will or at least look at it and update it. Often these estate planning documents go several levels deep. You know, I name this person in this capacity, but if something happens to them, I name this person. And that's good sound planning. But again, anyone in that mix, you know, the circumstances can change. I do a lot of wills in January. People get mad at someone over the holidays and they make a New Year's resolution to change their will. Certainly any major change in net worth, if someone hits the lottery, someone, you know, a retirement event or a business liquidation event, usually it's worth looking at your documents and you know, making sure they still make sense.
Okay. And lawyers typically send out a letter as well to remind people periodically that they should update their documents. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We have a caller. We have Candace from Bethlehem. Hello, Candace. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, good.
Good. How can we help you?
Sure. I have a question that's like somewhat related to this.
Okay.
As far as like for example, advance directives and making funeral arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
We ran into a snag. Like when my mom died, we ran into a snag where we picked a funeral home, and we were going to meet at. We were under the impression that they had two locations. We found out like unexpectedly that the location we were going to meet at had closed. So we had to like scramble and drive to the other location, and we're like, oh, great, now what do we do? You know, so it was like kind of like we didn't know until we had to plan the funeral. So like, you know, like I have my funeral arrangements in place, but then like when I went to update them, I realized that the funeral home I picked had merged with another, you know, because like I you know, had a few surgeries and I actually almost died on the operating table. Yeah. So it was like, you know, like I'm going like, well, great. Okay. You know, we already had that. What if something happens in like the funeral home I picked?
Right.
Or like maybe, if I go to a lawyer, like what, how do I handle that if like a lawyer's office merges.
Right. Well, we did talk about that with the lawyer offices merging,
uh-huh.
and that would be a really good question for any lawyer you go to, particularly if you're going to a sole practitioner. So
sure.
You could ask those kinds of questions. So let me see if Eric has any advice on or experience seeing what happens with the funeral home changes, because I have heard of that as well.
Well, so there are different options when you're working with a funeral director, which I am not a funeral director, but typically, so you can pre-plan a funeral and not pay for it. You're just coming up with a plan. You know, here's
right.
the string of pearls I want around my neck, or here's the who I want to read this hymn or sing this hymn or read this read. So you can pre-plan those things.
Mm-hmm.
You can also prepay. When you prepay, it's either typically it's either done with a small life insurance policy. Now, there are companies that specialize in issuing those policies, and that so there the funds are protected. They're held by a third party. You can also prepay a funeral. Many funeral directors maintain prepaid burial reserves, which are audited, and they're you know, under strict legal requirements to ensure the safety of those accounts. And if that funeral director you know sells their funeral home to another funeral home, those accounts would move with that practice. And any kind of contractual arrangement you have with your existing funeral director. If they transfer their business to another funeral director, that would be a liability that's assumed by the new funeral director.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that maybe it would just get like grandfathered in and that kind of stuff too. And then like we have the burial plots as well, and like at the church that my mom grew up in, and we have one available for my dad. The other thing is that particular congregation's also going through a pastoral change. So we're like, I'm like, oh gosh. I mean, thankfully my father is still alive, but it's like, oh goodness, what do we do now? You know,
that would be so. Most funeral, even if it's through a church, usually there's a separate association that manages
the
burial plots, and they would be the ones you'd talk to just to. Make sure everything's up to date.
But Candace, I thank you for your call, because these are all really good questions that one should ask. And as I say at the end of every show, you know, be proactive, not reactive. So you've raised, through your unfortunate circumstances, you've raised a lot of good questions for our other listeners to pay attention to and to ask when they're going into this. So thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome.
Appreciate it.
This is helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good evening.
Yep.
Thanks.
You too. Have a good evening.
Bye. Folks, we're at our next break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Introducing Home for the Holidays. 'Tis the season to shop small and share big. A new podcast launching November 6th. Each week, we'll spotlight local makers and retail stores that make our region shine and show how shopping small keeps local dollars close to home. So tune in, get inspired, and join the hashtag Buy Local movement. Listen at WDIY.org, watch on PBS 39's YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. I have with me in the studio attorney Eric Strauss of Gross McGinley. We're talking about further considerations in estate planning. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air, as Candace did with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Cindy. Eric, we were talking before the break and the call about reviewing documents. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the uses of the documents. So we said a copy, if someone dies, a copy isn't going to probably pass. We need the original. But let's talk about some of those other documents, the power of attorney, the living will, the health care. What might be some extra tips that we could give our listeners?
Great question. I mean, you can have the most clearly, perfectly drafted documents in the world. If people don't know how to use them and where to keep them and where they help, you know, actually the context of how they're used, they may not be as helpful as they could be. A medical power of attorney, that's a perfect example. A medical power of attorney it does two things. My medical power of attorney gives my doctor permission to talk to someone else. You know, we have HIPAA rules that protect our medical privacy, and they're very strict. And what I tell people, in the middle of the night when someone follows an ambulance to the hospital, they never remember to bring the power of attorney with them. And so with a medical power of attorney, I can name someone who my doctor has permission to talk to, and also who, if I'm not able to make a medical decision, I'm authorizing that person to make the decision for me. Those don't magically appear in the emergency room. So the best place to store your medical power of attorney is actually as part of your primary care records. So if you have a primary care physician, like locally here, Lehigh Valley Health Network, and well now Jefferson, but mm-hmm. and St. Luke's, their databases are merged. Many of the listeners have heard of the Epic database. So if someone's admitted to an emergency room, and that's usually the first time these things are used, mm-hmm. someone's admitted to an emergency room, the first thing they're going to do is look at your primary care records. They want to know what medication you take. They want to know if you are allergic to something, whether you have a pacemaker. And the idea is when they go into your primary care records, they're going to see that document, and it's going to tell them who they're allowed to talk to. And in our medical powers of attorney, we include all the contact information, cell phone, email.
I had no idea
that
you could give that to your primary care physician.
I think
in the portal or whatever.
I gave it to mine years ago before we had portals, but I think now you can just upload it.
Oh, that's really good
to
know.
Yeah, and that's huge. It can be very frustrating to show up at the hospital and say, how's my husband? How's my wife? Mm-hmm. How's my dad? We can't tell you. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
We get those calls all the time.
Mm.
You know, someone's at the hospital, hey, they're not talking to me, can you email me or send me a copy of the medical power of attorney.
Mm-hmm. So that's the medical power of attorney. Good, very good information.
Yep.
We have Greg from, I believe, Bethlehem on the phone. Hello, Greg. It's Lori. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. You had a question?
Yeah, just a question, not to go back, but real quick question. I have a will, and it's kept with McGinley, actually. But my partner has a will. She keeps it herself, but she keeps it in a safety deposit box. Is that smart, or is that going to be a problem if she dies? Nobody can get to the safety deposit box to get the will?
Actually, the safe deposit box is, if it's not going to be in a vault in a lawyer's office, the safe deposit box is probably the best place to keep it. And there is a provision in Pennsylvania law that allows, or actually requires, banks to grant access to a safe deposit box and to release a will to the executor named in the will.
So how do they know unless they go in and look
at
the...
They do. They go in.
Oh, they look, and then if it's who you say you are, they'll release it.
Correct. Now, the question is, where's the key to the safe deposit box?
Greg, do you know where the key to the safe deposit box is?
Worst comes to worst, I know where it is, and they could drill it out for a fee. I mean, I'm dying here.
Yeah, and that's the issue, you know, and this isn't a sales pitch for keeping documents with the lawyer. I give my clients a choice, and it really doesn't matter to me. But if it's with our office, and this, I did the same thing at my old firm, if it's with our office and the executor calls, which it's the person who does the will, it's their job to tell the executor, hey, my original will is either in the safe deposit box or it's at the lawyer's office or somewhere. But if it's with our firm and the executor calls and says, you know, my father passed away, we need his will, we'll release it to the executor named in the will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they want us to help them with the estate administration or not, it's not my will. We're mm-hmm. just safekeeping. We don't charge to do that. And so I think it's easier to get it. But again, the banks are required to allow the named executor to retrieve the will from the safe deposit box.
So, Greg, you could say to your partner, you know, it's okay if it's in the safe deposit box, but does the executor know who they are? Does the executor know it's in the safe deposit box? And does the executor know where the key is?
Yeah.
Okay?
That actually, the first part answers my question, that they have to open it and see that that's the executor and then release it. That's great.
Correct. Right. Correct.
Okay.
Okay, thank you so
much. All right,
much.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for calling. So we were talking about then the medical power of attorney. I just think that's a great tip, Eric. I just had never crossed my mind that you could upload it potentially to the medical portal, and
yep.
that's where they would look, because they would be looking for your other Medicaid.
Finish that thought, you know, around here, again, St. Luke's and Lehigh Valley, they're merged. I tell people, if you have a specialist at Geisinger, if you have a specialist at Penn, give them a copy too.
Mm-hmm. So that helps relieve it in those moments of stress when you're running to the hospital or chasing the ambulance and you didn't think to bring it. But otherwise, there again, you want the person who's giving you the agency to tell you where it is as well, correct?
Correct.
Because while the attorney will keep the original will, perhaps, you usually give original healthcare and financial powers of attorney to the clients.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So we have about a minute before our break, but I do want to talk about the importance of the agent for the power of attorney to know where the document is and where we should keep those as well, because you said the medical power of attorney should be kept with medical records. But what about that financial power of attorney? Because maybe we don't want someone to know they have the power of attorney just in case they, you know, start changing our bank accounts, et cetera. So maybe we could talk about that when we come back from the break.
We can talk about that a lot.
Okay. So, folks, we are almost at the halfway point. If you have questions, and we love questions, by the way, because it helps us you know, inform our listeners of the kinds of questions they should be asking. And we've had some great calls from from Greg and Candace earlier. So if you do have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us or give your question to Cindy, and they'll write it down and bring it in to us. But in the meantime, if you have not done your estate planning, we strongly encourage you to do so. Half the population doesn't do it, and we want you deciding where your assets go and who's making those very important decisions for you. And the only way you can do that is through your estate planning documents. We are at the break. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back. I just want to give a shout out to last night's event for WDIY fundraising. It was fabulous. It was at the State Theater in Easton. It was WDIY's Hollywood Squares, filled with very exciting, funny people, local Lehigh Valley leaders, and I hope that we get to do it again. So great job to Margaret McConnell and her team for bringing that all together, and all the volunteers who participated, and the staff as well. So thank you for that. We are speaking with Eric Strauss, attorney Eric Strauss from Gross McGinley. We're talking about further considerations in estate planning. So Eric, let's talk about the, you know, any other tips you might have on the documents, how we're using them, where we're keeping them, who should know about them. And in particular now, maybe the financial power of attorney.
Sure. And I'll start by saying a financial power of attorney is very, very different from a medical power of attorney. And it used to be that you would have a power of attorney that contained medical provisions and financial provisions, and then you'd have a separate, what's called a living will or an advance directive, which is really the, I call it the pull the plug document. Over the last several years, most lawyers have migrated to having one medical document that is your medical power of attorney and your living will. That goes to the doctor's office, and then you have a separate financial power of attorney, which strictly is limited to the financial powers that you're authorizing someone else to exercise on your behalf. And these are used very differently. And there are different signature requirements that it's important for people to understand. A medical power of attorney, I sign my medical power of attorney. I can name you as my medical agent. You don't have to sign anything. It's a self-activating document when I sign it. And usually it's used for the first time in an emergency. A financial power of attorney, very different, and it's signed differently. If I want to name you as my financial power of attorney, I sign a document. And then there's an acknowledgement on the back, that in the last page, that you have to sign. And in that acknowledgement, you acknowledge that you're going to act on my behalf. You're not going to steal my money. You're going to keep records of what you do. A bank will not accept that power of attorney until you sign it. Here's the thing. You don't have to sign it the same day I do. So I tell people that your agent should be aware that you have the power of attorney, but whether you give it to them and allow them to sign it right away is up to you. So if you're a very healthy person, very on top of your affairs, there's no reason, in my opinion, to have your agent sign the acknowledgement and to deliver a copy to the bank. Because once that happens, you give up your privacy. And I've seen it happen.
Mm-hmm.
I had a call last summer from a longtime client. 86-year-old gentleman, had outlived two wives, still ran two businesses, very successful gentleman, and he had named his son on his financial power of attorney. And I gave him the same speech I'm giving right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, I want him to sign it. I'll I just want it self-activating. Well, he meets this lady friend, and one day his son calls him out of the blue and says, Dad, you've been going out to dinner an awful lot lately. How did he know that? He had logged into the bank account? Yeah. And my client was irate. But I said, look, so that's the question. So it's something I talk to clients about. If I have someone, a client that's, visibly frail, and they say, my son or daughter comes over every Saturday to help me balance my checkbook, that's a person who maybe you want to start thinking about having them sign that power of attorney so it's in place. But someone who's young and in good health, I typically recommend that they not release the financial power of attorney. And when you think about how these things evolve, so let's say I have a stroke and I'm in the hospital, my medical power of attorney should be on file with my in my medical mm-hmm. records, and that's going to allow whoever's taking care of me to take care of the immediate emergency, okay? So if it's a minor stroke and I'm home next week, there's no need for anyone to have my my financial power mm-hmm. of attorney. If it's a massive stroke and I'm discharged to rehab for 3 months and the mail's piling up at the kitchen table and my tax return's due or someone needs to really step into my finances, that's the time to release the medical power of attorney.
The
financial power of attorney.
Mm-hmm. There are times when, you know, if you're married, husband and wife may name each other as
correct.
That financial power of attorney. So give me an example of, number one, does the spouse have to do the acknowledgement? Does that matter? But then what happens if we have to have a backup? So if I say, oh, my spouse, but my spouse and I might be in a simultaneous accident, mm-hmm. and maybe my son's the next power of attorney, does the contingent, or whatever you call it,
the backup
power of attorney have to sign the acknowledgement?
Correct. There's a separate acknowledgement.
There is a separate acknowledgement.
And I should, I mean, you pointed, made a good point. With a married couple, 99% of the time, those acknowledgements are signed reciprocal. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Many married couples, particularly if it's a first marriage situation, most of their accounts are jointly titled mm-hmm. anyway, so they would have, you know, pretty ready access to cash. But where you would need the power of attorney is, let's say, one spouse develops dementia and the other spouse decides to sell the home. They're signing as their spouse's agent mm-hmm. on the deed, so you would have mm-hmm. to use the power of attorney for that.
Mm-hmm.
Or if one spouse is disabled and the other needs to access their retirement account
mm-hmm.
to take an annual required minimum distribution, mm-hmm. you're going to need the power of attorney to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of those specific powers that a power of attorney under the PA statute, at least, you know, we do err out of Pennsylvania, so we tend to focus on that, and it could be different in different states, and we do have listeners from other states as well, but particular to Pennsylvania, there are specific powers that have to be listed in the power of attorney.
Correct.
Could you maybe touch on that for a moment too? Because sometimes I think powers of attorney, something happens to mom or dad and they come in with the power of attorney and they think they're going to quickly, you know, liquidate assets or move assets, thinking something might happen, and they may or may not have that power.
Yeah, that's a great question. Easiest way to start the explanation is, you know, a power of attorney is a permission slip, and it can be a very robust, complete power of attorney that I can give you the power to do anything I can do, or it can be limited. I only give you a limited power of attorney to sign the deed because I'm out of town the day my real estate sale occurs, okay? You know, most of the ones we draft are very robust. They're very, you know, complete documents. They talk about stock options. And someone may say, well, I don't own any stock options. Who knows? You might in the future. So we tend to throw in the kitchen sink mm-hmm. of sorts. There are certain powers that you would have to be very careful to make sure you understand what your documents say, because I see a lot of powers of attorney with boilerplate provisions that I'm not sure people really understand. And a couple issues that come to mind. Number one, support. Support of others. If you give me power of attorney over your finances, Lori, my job is to use your money to take care of you. Period. However, you may have an adult disabled child that you're supporting. You can give me permission to do that, but that has to be specifically granted. Mm-hmm. Okay. A related issue is gifting. You know, different people have different feelings about gifting. Some people never give anything to anyone. Other people, I have clients who write $1 million checks to their grandchildren, okay? Gifting has to be specifically addressed in the power of attorney. And there's a choice. You can say unlimited gifts, you can say no gifts, or something in between. I have a lot of people that like something to the effect of, I give my agent the power to make gifts to my spouse, children, grandchildren, and their spouses in amounts consistent with my past practice. So there would be a benchmark. So if that person gave each of the grandkids $50 for their birthday every year and ended up, you know, with dementia or incapacitated, the agent or the power of attorney could continue that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that permission has to be specifically granted. Now, a lot of people talk about access to digital assets. You know, who has the right to look, if anyone has the right to even see who I'm getting emails from, what we call the catalog of emails, date, time, sender, recipient, that you would typically want to grant because you know this better than I do. Most people manage their accounts online now.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be an executor or an agent would find a desk drawer with paper.
That's right.
or even a mess, but at least there's tangible, you know, breadcrumb trail of where assets are. Now, if everything's on a laptop.
Yeah, there's not even a checkbook sometimes.
You could have $20 million in an online brokerage account, and there isn't one scrap of paper in the house, right?
So that's a permission that one has to give.
Correct.
So again, a power of attorney agent might think they have that
correct
access, and they don't.
Correct. And it's not just that catalog of emails. It's the content of an email. So you might, I might want my executor to see generally the emails I'm getting. If I'm getting an email from Valley National once a month, it's probably a copy of a statement. And then I can follow up with Valley National, if I'm the agent or the executor even, because we do similar things in wills, to say, hey, I see an email coming from you. Does my mom or dad have an account with you? You know, that's important. But beyond that, there's a separate permission required to look at the content of an email. So I might want my agent to see who I'm getting email from, but I may not want them to be able to read my email.
Wow.
And you know, what we call the content of electronic communication, I mean, that could include, your pictures on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a communication.
Mm-hmm.
So those are things that, you know, we address in powers of attorney, but they're mm-hmm. important. And it
could be really important because you could have someone who has a momentary need for that power of attorney. You know, maybe they were in an accident, they're in the hospital with a brain contusion or whatever.
Correct.
You might call it.
Right.
And then, you know, 6 weeks later, they come out of it and find out, oh, my power of attorney had to run my financial affairs for 6 weeks. And then they realize, oh, wait, my son or daughter, who was the power of attorney, got into my accounts and
yeah.
did something else that were online.
I mean, another hot button is the power to change beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm.
Because many assets now are not controlled by a will, they're controlled by a beneficiary mm-hmm. designation. Think of your IRA or your brokerage account that's set up with a TOD, transfer on death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's frankly, it's becoming a problem. In the old days, if someone wanted to exercise undue influence, they'd, you know, drag grandma or grandpa or to a different lawyer. Here am I, you know, grandma wants to change her will and give everything to me. Okay. You know, now people are a lot more subtle. You know, they go online, they impersonate someone, they click on to change the beneficiary. So that is a power that has to be specifically addressed in the power of attorney. Do you want the person to be able to change the beneficiary designations or not? Often we end up, well, they can change the beneficiary designation or update it, but it has to be consistent with their overall estate plan.
Mm-hmm.
So the beneficiary change would typically track what the will says,
mm-hmm.
and that's extremely important.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And people need to understand these details and the importance of estate planning documents, because if you don't have those estate planning documents, what might happen, Eric? So if someone doesn't have the POA, someone's in an accident, what happens?
Let's
say there's no spouse, maybe there's a child.
You end up in an incapacity proceeding.
Uh-huh.
So someone who doesn't have a power of attorney, or where there's a power of attorney that for whatever reason isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
If there's co-powers of attorney and they're in a fight and the person who's involved, their affairs are held in suspension because two powers of attorney are fighting. You know, often those are situations where the Orphans Court, which is a branch of the Court of Common Pleas, gets involved, and it's a process. You have to have medical testimony that a person's incapacitated. A judge declares them, you know, as adjudicates them as an incapacitated person. At that point, they take on the legal status of a minor, so they lose their legal powers. And it can be what's called a plenary guardianship or a limited guardianship, but at that point, they lose their power. And that's an important difference between a power of attorney and a guardianship. I can name you as my power of attorney. If I do that and tomorrow you say, Eric, I think I want to move you to Sunny Rest Nursing Home up there, I don't have to go. I'm still
right.
in charge, right?
Right, right.
If you take me to court, if I have me declared as an incapacitated person and you're appointed as my guardian, you are in charge. I lose my legal power.
Folks, if that's not enough incentive for you to go do your estate planning, I don't know what it is. You know, quite often people will complain or think, oh gosh, attorneys cost so much money. But we also have to think the other side of that. How much money is it going to cost you if you end up in any of these kinds of situations? We're at our last break. So Eric, hold your thought and remember what you're going to say when we come back. If you have questions, there's still time. 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. I have in the studio with me this evening Eric Strauss, attorney with Gross McGinley. We're talking about further considerations in estate planning. We certainly hope that we encourage any of our listeners, if you have not already done your estate planning, to please do so. And if you have already done estate planning, please remember to do a review and understand how to use the documents. So, Eric, we were talking. Oh, if people have questions, 610-758-8810. You can also send questions through yourfinancialchoices.com. So, Eric, we were talking about, what were we talking about? The powers of attorney.
Well,
you were going to add something.
You were talking about the cost of using a
lawyer.
Oh,
yeah, the cost of using a lawyer.
And I'm not being cute. I just got brakes and tires on my car. And I spent a lot more than 90% of my clients do on a basic estate plan. And people ask, well, can I do a will on LegalZoom? Sure. And some people say, well, are those valid wills? And they're surprised. And I say, yeah, probably it is. Is it going to do what you think it's going to do?
Right.
Is it going to be lined up with the beneficiary designations on your retirement account? I mean, everything has to work together. And that's where I think, you know, using some of the online services, people are misled into what they actually do.
Well, yeah, and sometimes they even have the wrong state. Someone I know said, oh, look what I did. I did it myself. And, you know, when I looked at it, I'm like, well, seriously, California? You're not a resident of California. But anyway, Eric, we did have a caller off air, Robert from Allentown, and he asked about the medical power of attorney, how to send it to the hospital.
What most people, you know, so most primary care providers are linked with one of the networks. So if you take it to your primary care provider, and it's in their records, they could access it from the emergency room in the hospital. If you are going to a specific hospital for a specific procedure, they would typically, as part of the intake at the hospital, they would ask you if you have it, and they would keep a copy. And as I said earlier, I know some of my clients have, on their own, just uploaded it to their medical portal.
Mm-hmm. So
I have not done that, but I know it's done.
So, Robert, if you can't upload it to your portal, you could take it to your primary care physician and ask them if they could put it in part of the medical records.
Yep, they'll scan it, and they'll just make it part of your records.
Yeah, so, or as Eric said, if you're going specifically to the hospital, you could take it with them. Now, Eric, you did mention talking about asset titling. If someone's doing something online and they get this package deal, number one, you know, I try to tell clients, you know, your financial story is as unique as your thumbprint. So sometimes people will think, oh, I can go do my investing myself, I can go do my taxes myself, I can go do my estate work myself. And they're only kind of looking at it within that vacuum. And they don't realize how there are so many pieces that are interrelated. And I think as professionals, we see a lot of situations. And when they're doing it online, the online version might not know that you got a kid who's been battling a drug problem. They're doing really well recently, maybe for the past 3 or 4 years, but you have this inherent kind of fear that they might, you know, relapse or something like that. An attorney can walk you through the various scenarios that may occur, whereas the online software might not. That's just an example. So Eric, as far as the online, you also said, who's aligning the beneficiary designations? I can't tell you how often people come in and think their will is their estate planning. And they say, oh, yeah, I'm giving, you know, this money to charity in the will. And I say, well, none of your assets are going through your will. None of it's going to charity.
Right.
So can you talk about that for a minute?
Super important. And I'll give you a very, you know, I see this at least once or twice a week. You know, particularly with younger couples, you know, we have kids that are 8, 10, and 12 years old. They all seem like good kids, but if we die, we don't think they're old enough and responsible enough to manage the money. So so the will has a provision that says any beneficiary under age 25 or 30 or something, they don't get the money right away. It's held by a trustee who would manage the money. And if the children need it for tuition or something, you know, responsible and decent, the trustee can release money to them. If the child says, hey, I want a $250,000 car, the answer is probably no.
Mm-hmm.
So we go through these efforts to you know, craft these provisions into the will to provide how this trust would work. And that's unique. But there's, you know, some fairly standard concepts that people want to address in their what would be called a testamentary trust. So you do all that work in your estate planning in your will, or if some people like revocable trusts, but then you look at their $1 million IRA and it just has three little kids named as the mm-hmm. contingent beneficiaries. Well, if a minor is a beneficiary of a retirement account, they're not going to release the money to a minor. You have to, you know, go through court and either establish a guardianship or a restricted account. And in those cases, all that money is released when the child turns 18.
Mm.
Where in a trust, you can regulate when the money is released.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a huge concept. And, you know, you do a lot of financial planning and you do good work for your clients. But, you know, not every financial advisor knows that or is that thorough. And I've seen many times where we do all the planning and maybe there is a unique beneficiary, someone with substance abuse or someone who's eligible for a means-tested public benefit, or, you know, Medicaid-eligible SSI recipients, and you craft special trusts into your estate planning documents, and then, you know, a financial advisor who's maybe not as careful as you are says, oh, you don't do all that. That'll go through probate. You know, just name the kid as a beneficiary. Well, you've completely obliterated mm-hmm. all the work you did in your well-thought-out estate plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also let me mention, sometimes those beneficiary designations, so quite often we'll see primary each other's spouse.
Right.
But when you do have that testamentary trust language, really you should reach out to the attorney, because sometimes there's particular language they want to use or see
Correct.
In that contingent beneficiary designation to make sure that it goes through the way they want.
Correct. Typically, in my first example with where we have young children, you wouldn't say, I name my 3-year-old as my contingent beneficiary. You'd say, you know, you'd name the 3-year-old, but you say, but any beneficiary less than age 25 or 30, pay the money to the trustee of the trust I've established under my last will and testament,
mm-hmm.
dated whatever date. That's the way you get those what we call the non-probate assets into that trust.
Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it'll look like a contingent beneficiary on the custodian side might say special instructions or something like that, you'll see. So and if you are someone who is now a power of attorney for someone and you see that kind of language, you would have to probably reach out to the custodian brokerage firm to say, oh, what are those special instructions or what might they be, so that you understand what it is.
And it's super important to follow up on that side of it, because, you know, in the old days, and I, you know, the old days to me is maybe 10 years ago, you know, these were paper forms that people filled out, and you would just say see attached, and I would give clients a whole template that they could just attach to the company's beneficiary designation form. Now a lot of these things are completed online, and there's no uniformity as to how those forms are laid out. Some you know, financial institutions make it very easy to designate, you know, a what's called a testamentary trust as the beneficiary of a retirement account or a TOD account. Not all of them are. So sometimes you have to sort of escalate it and go to someone at the custodian, you know, the financial mm-hmm. institution that really knows and understands this.
Mm-hmm. And different custodians may have default beneficiaries as well. So if you're not putting the contingent on and something happens to your primary, the assets may go in a way that you didn't intend, because the default beneficiary might be the estate, or the default beneficiary might be the children. You know, per Stirpe's designation. So yep. you don't make any assumptions. You have to understand what it is. But Eric, you also brought up a really good point in the cases where you might have a beneficiary who would be entitled to Medicaid or you know, have a special needs trust, and you've gone through all the planning, and they, you know, the person puts a different beneficiary. But what I've also seen is where you may have a sister or a brother who doesn't have children, and they want to name your disabled child mm-hmm. as the beneficiary because they love your child, the special needs child, whatever. And they don't realize they could impede their receipt of special benefits that they can only get
correct
through the government.
Yeah, a lot of times when we're doing planning for families with special needs beneficiaries, we set up that supplemental needs trust as a separate document, so that if there are other loved ones that want to, you know, provide for that person, they if they want to, they can name the trust that you've set up. They don't have to pay their estate planning attorney to set up a special needs trust. You've already set it up. You've given them a bucket to direct their funds to. Because you're exactly right. If someone's receiving Medicaid or SSI benefits and you give them an outright inheritance, they can lose their benefits.
Yeah. So for any family members out there who are listening who really, you know, would just love to help that other family member, just, you know, have a conversation. Talk
right.
to whomever the parent is to make sure that you're not impeding anything like that.
Right.
So any other pitfalls or that you see for using alternatives like online wills? What about people who say, I don't need a will because I have everything non-probate. I've put beneficiary designations on everything.
You never know.
They always forget about the house, by
yep,
the way.
Yeah, you never know. No, because you do never know. I mean, I have people who come across inherited wealth that they never expected, people who literally have won the lottery.
Yeah. Lawsuits.
Yeah.
You know, somebody.
Yep. Yeah, so, you know, to have that basic, you know, and for most people, it's the basic set of documents in place is important. In terms of online alternatives, the new big white elephant in the middle of the room is AI. You know, mm-hmm. people think you can do everything with AI. Mm-hmm. And boy, you know, there's a...
I can't tell you how many times I've corrected it. And it says, oh, good job. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little... I mean, it's intriguing. It's fascinating. It's here. But there's, you know, some very large pitfalls. And honestly, you know, it's becoming the way that many lawyers are practicing law, and anyone who's working with an attorney, make sure you're asking them what their AI policy is.
Mm.
Because, you know, if your lawyer is sharing your, you know, drafting documents for you on ChatGPT, that your information is out there.
Mm.
You know, there are closed system AI that you can, you know, that can assist with document drafting. And frankly, you know, lawyers are going to start having to be up to speed on it because it, you know, it's more efficient. But you have to be smart with how you use it.
Yeah. Thanks, Eric. Yeah. Eric, we've got 1 minute left. Thank you so much for being here. It's just been wonderful. We could go on and on and on. It's our favorite subject to talk about, Eric and I. So you'll have to come on again. But if people would like to reach you, you're at Gross McGinley Attorneys at Law. And what is the phone number there?
610-820-5450.
And your email address? I don't know if that comes through.
It's
or
complicated.
Okay.
eStrauss@GrossMcGinley.
Oh, eStrauss@GrossMcGinley. Thank you so much for being here. And
it's been great.
Final things, make sure you have your documents, right?
Yep.
Okay. Folks, thank you for listening. I want to thank our callers this evening. Great questions. Those questions always help other listeners, so we really appreciate it. I think it was estate planning week or estate planning month, so my strongest desire is always to get more and more people to face, you know, what ultimately is going to happen. Don't be afraid. I say if you plan, nothing happens. So go ahead and do your estate planning, because then maybe you'll live even longer and you'll think, oh gosh, that was worth it. So I want to thank Bob and Cindy for being here. Thank you, James, for being here. Thank you, listeners. Next week, I'm going to talk about understanding retirement accounts. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices, and have a great week.